I'm going to continue on the subject of these epistemic approaches. There's a few reasons. One, I think they provide some motivation for pursuing hidden variable models. So often I find hidden variable models get a bad rap, but if you look at them in a particular way, I think they're extremely appealing. So I want to try to show you some of the appeal of a hidden variable approach if you treat psi epistemically. Also, it'll provide an example of an axiomatic approach to deriving quantum theory, the formalism of quantum theory. And it also sheds light on the approach that says that quantum theory is ultimately just a revision on probability theory. So it hits all those bases. And furthermore, it's a topic that's close to my heart because this is the sort of thing I work on. So I'm used to making this kind of argument. So I'm indulging myself by giving you a lecture on this subject. Yes?
Variables theories, and also showing good things about psi epistemic models. But you can have psi epistemic models that are not invariable.
The way I'm using the terminology, I would say no, because a psi epistemic model is necessarily psi incomplete. So it adds things. And so the way I use the term hidden variable, if knowing everything about the preparation procedure, there's still something unknown, then I would say, well, there's something hidden. And we'll call those hidden variables.
Okay, so in this vocabulary, would a hidden variable model, like for example, you know, when you do the spin measurement, it comes in and it goes spin down. Was there like necessarily a hidden variable with a value of spin down, like all the way as the electron is coming in, or is that like not? Maybe I'm a little confused what you mean by hidden variable models.
Or maybe it'll be clarified.
Well, people disagree on how to use the term, but for the purpose of this course, I made this categorization into psi complete, which is like the orthodox approach, and then there's psi ontic and psi epistemic. If you're psi incomplete and psi ontic, I call that psi supplemented. So what I mean by hidden variable approaches are psi supplemented and psi epistemic models. So in a psi supplemented model, there's more than just a wave function.
Okay.
That's a hidden variable. That's like Bohmian mechanics, which we'll come to. In psi epistemic models, there are variables underlying the wave function. The wave function is like a probability distribution, and the variables under it, which are also hidden. So both of those sorts of models I refer to as hidden variable models. OK, so I'm first going to provide an argument in favor of this psi epistemic approach in terms of a few analogies with Liouville mechanics. So Liouville mechanics is the theory about probability distributions over phase space. And so I'm going to contrast the analogy that exists between quantum mechanics and Liouville mechanics with the analogy that exists between quantum mechanics and Newtonian mechanics, of the theory of how the points in phase space actually move. So first example will be the impossibility of discriminating non-orthogonal states. So you saw this in tutorial. You, I think, proved that using the most general POVN, you still can't discriminate non-orthogonal states. So you can ask, well, what does that mean? You know, why is that? Well, here are two non-orthogonal states. And if you take the Newtonian analogy, then these quantum states correspond to ontic states, complete descriptions of reality. So they're like two points in phase space. And now there's no analogy to the idea that you know you shouldn't be able to distinguish two points in phase space. Nothing prevents us from doing it. So if you want to take the view that these quantum states describe something real, then you have to say, well, somehow measurements are more limited in our world than in a classical world. And so for some reason, even though two states are different realities, one can't find a measurement that discriminates them. The Liouville analogy makes this more natural, because these two non-orthogonal quantum states will be represented by probability distributions that overlap. So the task of discriminating a pair of non-orthogonal states in the analogy with Liouville becomes the following task. I've prepared a system. Its physical state is a point in phase space. I've done one of two preparation procedures. If I did the first one, then that point has been sampled from this distribution here. And if I did the second procedure, then the point in phase space describing its physical state has been sampled from this distribution. And so given that one sample, your task is to figure out, you know, which probability distribution was it sampled from. And so clearly, you can't always succeed. Because when it happens to fall in this overlap region, its physical properties are consistent with both preparation procedures. It could have arisen from being sampled by this guy or by this guy. So nothing about it can possibly tell you which preparation procedure it came from. And so some of the time, you're necessarily not going to be able to tell. But if it happens to be in this region or this region, then you can conclusively determine which one it came from. So this provides a natural view on why you can't discriminate them without error. But the thing that I find also quite nice is that you know also from tutorial, I think, that you can do unambiguous discrimination, which means you have covered that, yep. There's a three outcome measurement where one outcome tells you it's definitely this guy, another outcome tells you it's definitely this guy, and the third outcome says, I don't know, inconclusive. Now, if you think that these are states of reality, then again, there's no analog. But furthermore, that doesn't strike me as following necessarily from the fact that you can't estimate these correctly with certainty. So if I say you're living in a world where physical states cannot be distinguished with certainty, does it follow that your world allows you to sometimes, you know, discriminate them conclusively and sometimes fail to know? Well, it doesn't seem to lead to that conclusion. It's just sort of something more you have to assume about how the world works, or something you have to explain in terms of the dynamics and measurement procedures. Whereas here, it comes very naturally. You say, not only can you not with certainty tell me which of these two is, it also follows that you can do unambiguous discrimination by asking, is it over here in this region where it's definitely sampled from this guy, or this region where it's definitely sampled from this guy, or is it somewhere in the middle, in which case I don't know. So there's sort of a natural explanation of unambiguous discrimination as well. Yes?
What about the case in which the two distributions have identical support, but are still different distributions? They assign values differently over the identical support. Then there's the overlap is complete.
Right. So then the best you could hope for, you certainly couldn't do unambiguous discrimination in that scenario. And the best you could hope for is to get some probability of telling them apart, because maybe one of them has more weight over here and the other one has more weight over there. So if you wanted to explain, for example, the fact that for any two non-orthogonal quantum states, you always have some probability of success in an unambiguous discrimination, then that tells you that, you know, non-orthogonal states should always be represented by not completely overlapping distributions, because if they were, I couldn't explain that.
Okay, so that's something that you have.
That's going to be a constraint. Yeah, okay. Exactly. So questions on that? All right, a second example. The lack of exponential divergence of physical states under chaotic evolution. So in a classical world, you get exponential divergence of ontic states. That's the signature of chaos. So if I have 2 points in my phase space that start off close together, and I have chaotic evolution, I can find that the distance between those points grows exponentially. Now, in quantum theory, you might say, well, that if the quantum state is the analog of a point in phase space, it ought to do something similar, you might expect. But now you note that the one natural candidate for a notion of distance between points in the state space would just be the overlap of the quantum states. So you look at the overlap between psi 1 and psi 2 evolved to time t. But because this is unitary evolution, psi 2 of t is just u of psi 2 at time 0. And u dagger u is just identity. So the overlap, not only does it not exponentially diverge, it doesn't change at all. Right? The overlap is constant. So this was seen as a puzzle by many people. You know, where's the signature of chaos in quantum theory? One doesn't have this exponential divergence. If you make the Newtonian analogy, well, as I said, that's puzzling. If you make the analogy to Lieben mechanics, this appears more natural, because now the analog of a quantum state is a distribution over the phase space. So if the analogous thing to an inner product is an overlap of distributions. So the way one talks about distances between probability distributions, there are many metrics, but a common one is this one here. It's called the classical fidelity. And you just take the square root of one distribution times the square root of the other, and you integrate over the ontic state space. So this has the nice feature that if these distributions are completely non-overlapping, it's zero. All right, so they're basically, the fidelity is sort of an inverse measure of distance. So fidelity zero means they're as far apart as they can be. And if mu 1 is equal to mu 2, then this just becomes mu, and I integrate it and I get 1. And fidelity 1 corresponds to basically being the same, distance 0. So that's like the inner product, which also is 0 for things that are far away and 1 for things that are the same. So if you look at this classical fidelity for a distribution that has evolved for a time t, you find it's actually exactly the same as the classical fidelity for the initial pair of distributions because of Liouville's theorem. So if you remember from classical mechanics, Hamiltonian evolutions preserve areas in phase space. So if there's a certain area of overlap of these two distributions, then that will be preserved under Hamiltonian evolution. And it'll always be the same area of overlap. And in fact, it'll always have the same classical fidelity. So again, it seems to have a better analogy with the quantum case. And from these sorts of intuitions, people like Asher Perez and Carl Caves and others argued that the quantum signature of chaos, if you want to know what the quantum signature of chaos is, well, ask, what's the classical signature of chaos for Liouville distributions? And you can find signatures of chaos. You can say, for example, if I evolve one distribution with one Hamiltonian and another distribution with a Hamiltonian wherein the parameters are slightly changed, do I find that the fidelity between those distributions goes down exponentially quickly? It turns out that's the case for quantum, for chaotic evolutions. And so you can do the same in the quantum case. You can now say, well, what if I modify the parameters in the Hamiltonian a little bit and I evolve one quantum state according to one Hamiltonian and the same quantum state according to the other Hamiltonian? Do they diverge? And one finds the answer is yes. So you have an analogy in terms of the signatures of chaos. Kira?
Is that the framework used for quantum chaology or quantum chaos?
Well, there's a lot of work done in quantum chaos, and not all of it proceeds from this sort of perspective. So I'm not an expert on the whole field, but I remember when I looked into it, I found this sort of approach the most natural answer to the question of, you know, where is chaos in quantum theory. But there are probably experts who would disagree and try to argue that you can have a view that this is a description of reality and still understand quantum chaos. Aaron.
Systems. The point, yes. I thought the point was that you don't tweak the Hamiltonian, that it's this, you know, sensitive dependence on initial conditions.
Yes.
So like, are you like, I feel like there must be a way to have, like, if you have a chaotic system. Mm-hmm. Oh, or is that the point? Is the idea that if you have a classical chaotic system and you turn it into a statistical system, it's no longer chaotic?
No, the point is just that it's, if you ask, you know, what's the signature of chaos for distributions, it's not an exponential divergence, right? So if I have two distributions that overlap, okay, then how do they evolve under chaotic evolution? Well, the area in phase space underneath one distribution will sort of become stretched out and maybe very spaghetti-like, and so points close together become far apart in that distribution. But the other distribution, the same thing happens, and so their overlaps remain the same. So maybe you need to characterize how the support of the distribution is sort of extended over the phase space, or you need to do something else. And so one thing you can do is look at evolution under slightly different Hamiltonians, and you find that that's enough. You can distinguish regular systems from chaotic systems by looking at those sorts of differences.
Okay. Like you can tell whether the underlying, like if you have classical systems of mechanics, you can tell whether the underlying classical system is chaotic or not by looking at this, by tweaking the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You already answered half of this, but classically, our distributions are that there's still object points which are spreading out exponential,
yep,
divergence,
yep,
and so we have to have the support of these distributions is getting larger.
Well, the area is the same. It's becoming sort of more tenderly over time, so. You know, if you have a particular area in phase space and it starts evolving, then it might so it's this. The area is the same, but it's, you know, starting to spread. So maybe over time it gets even thinner and spread over larger areas. I don't know exactly how to draw
it. Why couldn't you just have the weight at weight across the support go down, right? The density go down, of points of phase space go down, rather than it becoming...
The volume of the phase space is going to be constant or complement.
Yeah, so I guess I'm drawing here the contour. Say this contains 90% of the probability of your distribution.
I
say that's the contour I'm drawing. Then that contour will tend to be able keep a constant area, but it will change in shape.
But my question was, how do they can reverse that analogy, and what does that say, like, about quantum states and chaotic systems, where, does the analogy tell us anything going the other way?
I don't quite know what you mean.
Well,
can you learn something about cosmic chaos from...
No, what I mean is that using this idea that, you know, in order, the chaotic systems, you get these strange shapes to your...
Is there a quantum analog of this?
Yeah.
Is that your question? I don't know. There may be. Maybe. Yes?
Since in Newtonian mechanics, what is actually diverging is the position, the distance between two states in terms of position, would it be possible to use the position operator in the quantum theory to say that the average position of one corresponding to one state should be related to the average position, well, should maybe diverge from the average position of another state?
It's a good question. It may be that things like average position could be used, but you might, so I don't know whether that would be a signature of chaos or not. If you had a system with closed boundary conditions, then you might have a problem because it, you know, there's only so far that the position can diverge to.
Yeah, it's right. Also the case for Newtonian mechanics.
For what? For
Newtonian mechanics. If you have a bounded region,
right. That's true. That's a good question. It's very likely that people know the answer to this question. I don't. I think maybe we should move on because otherwise, you know, we'll never get to the other stuff. So a third example is the impossibility of cloning non-orthogonal states. So we haven't seen this so far, but it's really quite simple. So I'll take you through it. I'm going to consider the example where you're trying to clone one of two non-orthogonal states. There's also a no-cloning theorem for the set of all quantum states. But this is a very simple version of the theorem. Think of it as being like the problem of distinguishing two non-orthogonal states. So the task is you've got a system. It's been prepared in either the quantum state Psi1 or Psi2 and passed on to you. And you don't know whether it was prepared in Psi1 or Psi2. And your task is to prepare a second copy of whatever state it was prepared in, which you don't know. So if it's Psi1, you bring up an ancilla in some fixed state chi, and you implement a map on the pair that leaves you in Psi1 tensor Psi1. If it's Psi2, you should be left in Psi2 tensor Psi2. So you need one map. The map can't depend on whether it's Psi1 or Psi2, because you don't know whether it's Psi1 or Psi2. You need one map that will take the Psi1 case to this and the Psi2 case to that. And the question is, can you do it? Any idea? Well, clearly you can't, but any idea why you can't?
Send in a superposition.
Send in a superposition to try to do it?
Yeah.
Well, the problem is you don't prepare the system, right? The system is, I've prepared the system in either Psi1 or Psi2 and passed it to you. You don't know which it is. You can't turn it into a superposition of Psi1 and Psi2.
It amplifies the probability of detecting non-orthogonal states past the limit that we proved.
But you proved a limit. How can you amplify it beyond that limit?
By using the fact that we now have two copies.
So your task is to make the clone. You're not given two copies. You're given one copy.
Right.
Your task is to make two copies.
Oh, I thought we had such a device that we tried to show that.
Sorry. So what I'm asking is, one can imagine this device as a logical possibility. And now I'm asking, why is it physically impossible to build this device given the laws of quantum mechanics?
Right.
And so now I think there was an answer in there somewhere.
Answer to that question.
Sorry? Yeah, okay, so I was misunderstanding what you're saying, but you're absolutely right. If you could build such a device, then your probability of discriminating two states would increase because you'd be left with two copies, and you can distinguish two copies of Psi 1 from two copies of Psi 2 better than a single copy, and so clearly such a device is not possible. Yes, that is a good proof. Sorry, I didn't understand you at first. There's a slightly simpler, I mean, there's many ways of seeing this. It all ties together as a type factor. But a very simple way of seeing it is by looking at whether there exists a unitary to do this. So the inner product has to be constant in unitary evolution. So suppose I take the inner product between psi 1 chi and psi 2 chi, the two possible initial states. That's this here. Well, the overlap of chi and chi is 1, so I'm just left with the overlap of psi 1 and psi 2. I'm taking the absolute value of the overlap. And now look at the overlap of the two possible final states. That's just this, psi 1 overlap with psi 2. That's psi 1, psi 2 modulus squared. So if there's going to be a unitary that does this, this overlap has to equal this overlap. And that's only possible if this quantity is 0 or 1. If it's 0, they're orthogonal states. So that tells me that I can clone orthogonal states because I could just measure them, figure out which one I have, and make as many copies as I like. Or they're the same state, in which case I have no uncertainty about what the state is. You know, I'm told I'm going to either give you psi 1 or psi 1. Now make some more copies. Well, obviously you can because you know exactly what it is. Those are the only situations in which you can do this cloning map. If you imagine more general evolutions, non-reversible evolutions, they're only going to make things less distinguishable. As a result, you're not going to have any better ability of achieving cloning.
Yep.
A simple proof of the fact that adding irreversible maps is not going to help you. You can add an ancilla in here, and then you can let that ancilla go to one of two different states, and imagine it. You know, you can think of any irreversible evolution as a unitary on some extra ancilla. And so then you look at the overlap of the two final states, and you have this term plus an overlap of two possible ancilla states, and just this term over here. And now all that overlap of two possible ancilla states is going to do is potentially make this smaller, not bigger. And so it's not going to help to have that extra kind of transformation. Okay, so again, if you think these are states of reality, then there's no obvious analogy. But if you think that these are distributions, then the task becomes to clone a distribution. So you have to think of that as follows. I've given you a sample of one of two distributions, either mu1 or mu2. And your task is to prepare a second sample. So I want you to prepare something such that it looks exactly what it would look like if I'd sampled it from mu1 or I'd sampled it from mu2. I didn't say that very clearly. You want to prepare a second system in such a way that if I give you first system sample from U1, your second thing looks like it was sampled from U1, and if I give you one sample from U2, your second looks like it was sampled from U2. So the idea is you have some unknown distribution, you have a second system in some distribution, and you want a map that takes you to a product distribution which corresponds to whatever the first one was. Good. So think of it this way. The person who prepared the first system, this describes that person's knowledge. And you'd like to implement a procedure such that at the end of the day, that guy says, right, here's how I can describe the pair system. This is my knowledge of the pair. And this corresponds to knowing that there are no correlations between them. So you'd like to leave the person in a situation where he knows that both of them knows the same thing about both, and there are no correlations between them. So any clues as to whether this sort of machine is possible in a classical world?
To preserve classical fidelity under time evolution?
Exactly. Again, by Liouville's theorem, the classical fidelity has to be constant. So let's look at the classical fidelity of the two possible initial states. It's this, right? So square root of mu1 nu, square root of mu2 nu. If I integrate these up, well, I have a root nu and a root nu, so I just get nu, and that integrates to 1. It's a normalized probability distribution. So I'm just left with the classical fidelity between mu1 and mu2. Now, if I look at the classical fidelity between the two possible final states, well, I have a mu1 and a mu1, and so I get that classical fidelity squared. So I have one integral over z and one integral over y here. And so again, I say, well, when are those two things equal? And the answer is only if this quantity is 0 or 1. When it's 0, that corresponds to two distributions that are disjoint, which means I could just find out, you know, is it this distribution or is it that one? I can make as many copies as I want after that. Or it's the same distribution, in which case, again, you know, I can just make copies because there's no ambiguity. So actually, this example, I found out about it from Chris Spooks in the late 90s. And it, for me, actually, was very decisive in exciting me to the idea of this way of thinking about quantum mechanics. It was one of the things that sort of tipped the balance for me and thought, well, that's just a little bit too compelling to ignore. Yes?
This might be a little in advance of when I should ask this one, but why are we saying that Louisville mechanics is medicine? Because we could instead just say that the object states of Newtonian mechanics aren't actually real because there's always some position uncertainty, and in fact, this is a kind of continuum limit of quantum mechanics. Even. I mean, it's not clear to me that the epistemic interpretation of Louisville mechanics is.
It may not be the only interpretation, but it certainly seems the most natural one. If we were in a time before quantum theory, and you know everyone knew Newtonian mechanics, and then people started studying how to evolve distributions of states, and somebody said, "I have a new interpretation of that distribution. It doesn't represent your knowledge of some underlying reality. Somehow there is no underlying reality, and it just represents what is." I think people would appropriately say that's bizarre, and furthermore. You know, you're sort of getting into the Heisenberg-Bohr omelet of, you know, confusion between epistemology and ontology. In the classical case, it's, you know, it's very clear there's a distinction between what is and what we know about it. And the distributions are a quantitative description of what we know about it. And so I think, although there's a logical possibility, maybe you can say there's a way of interpreting distributions differently from the way they're traditionally interpreted. I see these sorts of analogies as saying, you know, maybe what it's telling us is that we should have an epistemological attitude towards the quantum state and think of it that way as knowledge about something else, and that might resolve some of the conceptual confusions. I don't know if that satisfies you, but...
So I'm sure you can get to this, but are there quantum effects that can't be encapsulated in some sort of Louisville analogy?
There are, yeah. And normally I would tell you about those, you know, up front, so that, you know, you don't get the wrong idea. But today I'm going to tell you about that at the end. So I'm going to lead you along and say, oh, isn't this great? At the end, I'll tell you what it can't do. Okay, so far I've just been talking about, you know, a real classical world where I have limited knowledge. And so I guess in some sense I will tell you a little bit about how it failed, but I'm going to fix these failures. At the end I'll tell you about failures that you can't really fix. So the problem is that if you look at pure states in Louisville mechanics, so think of these as the states that are extremal in the convex set of states. So they're the ones which you can't decompose into a mixture of other states of knowledge. They're just the Dirac delta functions in space. Right? So if you ask, what's complete knowledge? The answer is, you know everything about position and momentum. Now these guys here, they always have strictly disjoint support, right? They don't overlap. Hence, they're distinguishable. They're clonable. If I, you know, tell you I prepared either x1p1 or x2p2, make a clone, you can do it. Distinguish them, you can do it. There's no problem. So the Newtonian, and this is just another way of saying that the Newtonian states correspond to states of knowledge. They're the states of complete knowledge in classical mechanics. So there's no real distinction between these two guys. What we were really using was the fact that quantum states are analogous not to any old states of knowledge, but states of incomplete knowledge, ones where, you know, the distribution actually had some non-trivial support. So what it suggests is that maybe you can get a better analogy by looking at Louisville mechanics with what I call an epistemic restriction, a fundamental constraint on how much knowledge you can have about the physical state, so that your distributions will always have some non-trivial support and can never be delta distributions. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to tell you about building such a model and seeing what kinds of analogies you get with quantum theory. So this is based primarily on some unpublished work I've done with Steve Bartlett and Terry Rudolph. But I'll also tell you about things like the Wigner representation and some more standard results. Okay. For some reason, it's not changing. Oh, there we go. Might act up. Okay. Yes, I thought I would do that. So you start with Liouville mechanics. And what I'm going to do is to figure out what a good epistemic restriction might look like, I'm going to take a look at quantum theory. I'm going to look in particular at the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in quantum theory. And that will give me some guide for how to build an uncertainty principle for my classical theory. So I'm just waiting for, I think it will go back to full screen mode momentarily. But this is what's important here. So in quantum particle mechanics, you can write down the Heisenberg uncertainty principle in this form here. So it's not quite the form you're probably more familiar with. So it's not just delta x delta p gradient equal to h power over 2. This form is called the Robertson-Schrodinger form of the uncertainty relation. And it has this extra term here, which is a cross-correlation between position and momentum. So Cxp is this. So here's this. So it turns out that the form of the uncertainty principle that you can actually saturate, the inequality you can actually saturate, is this one, which involves these cross correlations. I'm a bit concerned that it's not responding. Let me take a minute just to. Oh, here we go. Good. Okay, so let me just remind you, these variances are the difference between the expectation value of the square and the square of the expectation value. Here's the cross correlation I told you about. And all the expectation values here, of course, just trace of some operator with the density operator. So now I want to know, does that guide me to coming up with some restriction? Here's the idea. These quantities, delta x, delta p, cross correlation, they could all be defined in terms of a classical probability distribution. So instead of rho, I have some mu of xp now. Right? So this is just a classical probability distribution over phase space. And I have position variables, momentum variables, and so on. So I have functions over that phase space, which correspond to observables. And I can talk about the expectation value of those functions now. And so I can define a variance in position in terms of a probability distribution like this one. I can also define a cross-correlation between position and momentum. And so I could make this demand, this constraint, on my probability distributions. I could say the only distributions that will be allowed are those for which delta x times delta p are too small. Yeah, by saturate the inequality, I meant in the case where you just take delta x, delta p, gradient equal to h bar over 2, you're ignoring the cross correlations. And so typically, you don't get that equal to h bar over 2. But if you incorporate the cross correlations, then you can get equality here. That's what saturate just means, get equality in the inequalities. OK. Yes?
With the regular uncertainty principle for the ground state of the harmonic oscillator?
If you don't have cross correlation between x and p, yes. Right. So in that case, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, this expectation, this will go to 0, and so you'll saturate it. Yeah. But if you have a distribution with some cross correlation, say you squeeze it so that it's sort of long and thin along the diagonal, then this is the inequality that you can saturate. Because if you squeeze it along the diagonal, you'll find very big delta x, very big delta p, and you'll be way over h bar over 2. And it's the fact that x and p are highly correlated that'll bring this quantity down in size. So this sort of characterizes the area in phase space in some sense. So anyways, that's the idea. You just say, well, let's take that uncertainty principle and really interpret it as an uncertainty principle. It says that you are uncertain about a position and a momentum which actually exist. Okay, so this is what I'm imagining. For a single particle in 1D, I'm going to impose the following constraint. It's a slight modification from this. So it says the only Liouville distributions that can be prepared are those that satisfy this inequality, and furthermore, that have maximal entropy for a given set of second order moments. So if you there are many distributions that have a particular delta x and a particular delta p. There's like a top hat distribution, there's a Gaussian, and so on. I'm going to only take those that maximize the entropy. Turns out that that's something you have to do to get a nice analogy with quantum theory. And if you look among the distributions that have a given set of second order moments, which are the ones that maximize the entropy? The answer are the Gaussians. That might be familiar to you, it might not. It's not that hard to prove, but I won't do it today. You could think of your epistemic restriction is instead as, you know, you're only allowed Gaussian distributions that have these kinds of variances. So that's the idea. So what kinds of distributions are you allowed? Well, they have to be positive, normalized, and they have to have a Gaussian form. So here's a typical one. But I could make the variance in position small and the variance in momentum compensate that. So I could squeeze it, and I could squeeze it along any axis I want. And if I could even squeeze it infinitely to the point where it's a delta function along x, and it's uniform along p. Or I could squeeze it infinitely along p and let it be uniform along x. But I can't have a distribution where I know both x and p, and I can't have some arbitrary distribution with arbitrary profile. So now you start to have analogies with quantum theory. So these are like your position eigenstates. These are like your momentum eigenstates. These are like what quantum opticians call coherent states. Yes?
So it's the maximal entropy condition that throws out that.
That's right. Yeah. Now, there's also a distinction between pure and mixed here. So in this context, I'm again talking about pure and mixed relative to the set of distributions you can prepare. So the definition of purity in the theory of convex sets is if you have an element that can't be decomposed into a mixture of other elements, it's pure. So if you take one of these distributions and you ask, can I write it as a mixture of other valid distributions, the answer is no. You know, it's as narrow as it can get. So it can only be written in terms of itself. Similarly with this guy. So relative to the distributions that are allowed and valid, these guys are pure. But I could take a bunch of these guys and shift them in x and p and weight them with a Gaussian and get a Gaussian that doesn't saturate the uncertainty principle. So it's got a much larger delta x and delta p than it needs. And this is allowed in the theory. But it's mixed. It turns out that there are, you can decompose it into other states. Similarly with this guy, he's just, I'm imagining here, a uniform distribution over the whole phase space. That'll be mixed as well. That's like the completely mixed state for a qubit at the center of the block sphere. Yes?
The one on the top has saturated the inequality and it's got maximum. Well, they all have maximum.
They all have maximum.
They all have maximum entropy.
They have maximum entropy for those second order moments.
Yeah.
And this guy doesn't saturate the inequality. Right. Yes?
So the condition of having maximum entropy for second order moments, this is not preserved by Hamiltonian.
Not arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution, no. So in a moment I'll get to what dynamics are allowed to preserve that constraint. And what you'll find is that the Hamiltonians... What's that?
Arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution will preserve
this. Arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution preserves the uncertainty principle, but that extra constraint of maximum entropy is not preserved by arbitrary Hamiltonian evolution. That's right. The first version of this theory we wrote down, we thought, oh, maybe we can have arbitrary distributions, not Gaussians. And it ended up being unlike quantum theory in many ways. And so this is the one that eventually we realized is provides the nice analogy. So, yes?
So you can only construct some mixed states. I cannot take any two pure states and take half one plus half.
That's correct. You can't do those sorts of, because what you get by doing that are things that don't satisfy this maximum entropy constraint.
So this is not, this breaks the analogy from this.
That's true. That is one of the ways in which this is not like quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is closed under arbitrary convex combinations, and this is not. But one sense in which it is analogous is that you have multiple different decompositions of a mixed state into pure states. So remember, we had that in the Bloch sphere, where the complete mixed state could be decomposed into 0 and 1, or plus and minus. And that was one of the things that seemed very puzzling when you thought of pure quantum states as states of reality. Here, in the context of this totally classical theory, it's quite natural. It just says, if you know nothing, then you can think of that as not knowing whether you're in one of these states of well-known position, but completely unknown momentum, or whether it corresponds to not knowing whether you're in one of these states of well-known momentum. So there's two ways of decomposing your ignorance. You could say, well, I choose to learn just about position, or I choose to just learn about momentum. Now, this, if we want to go beyond and start talking about things like entanglement, we need to write down a theory for multiple systems. So then you can ask, well, what happens in quantum mechanics? What's the uncertainty principle for arbitrary number of systems? This is something you don't see often, but it's the generalization of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle to arbitrary numbers of canonical systems. So the first piece here is called the covariance matrix. So it has the variance of the position of the first particle, variance of momentum of the first particle, variance of the position of the second particle, and so on. On the off diagonals are cross correlations between x1 and p1. Here it's between x1 and x2, and so on. Okay, so defined in this sort of way. So this thing basically gives you all the second order moments for your quantum state. And this sigma is something that is familiar from classical mechanics. It's called the symplectic matrix. Okay, so it's zero everywhere except in these 2x2 blocks on the diagonal, where it's this matrix 0, minus 1, 1, 0. And so to interpret this is a matrix equation. It says, take this matrix, add I times h bar this matrix, and demand that that be a positive matrix. So what you'd have to do, this really encodes a whole bunch of inequalities, right? So you could take this sum of matrices, find all of its eigenvalues, and then set those greater equal to 0. Turns out this whole thing is a positive matrix, so all those, this whole thing is a Hermitian matrix. So all those eigenvalues are real, and you just set them positive, and you get a whole bunch of constraints. So let me convince you that this reduces to the case that we saw for a single particle in 1D. So for a single particle, here's the covariance matrix, variance in X, variance in P, cross correlations here. You add IH bar times the symplectic matrix, and you get this guy here. So you just have a minus a half IH bar and a plus a half IH bar down here because of this factor of 2. And you want to set that to 0. For a 2x2 matrix, it's sufficient to just set to make the determinant positive. If the determinant is positive, then the eigenvalues are positive. So if you take the determinant of this, it's just the product of the variance in X and the variance in P minus this product. And that product gives me a cross correlation squared, and it gives me an h bar over 2 squared term. And so if I just rearrange things, I get the uncertainty principle we had on the previous slide. Okay. So what you do is you just, again, make exactly the same restriction on your distributions. Everything in this covariance matrix could be defined in terms of some probability distribution over a big phase space for particle 1, particle 2, et cetera. And so I can just make this a constraint on those distributions mu. Now, question, I could go over the proof of this in quantum mechanics if it seems mysterious to people. It's sort of a nice little piece of quantum mechanics. Or I could continue with sort of this narrative of what this hidden variable model does for you. Yes, question. Yep.
Last slide, you said something about the determinant having to be positive.
Yep.
But like that uncertainty principle actually requires that every element of those matrices be positive?
No. The constraint of when I write down an equation like here's a matrix and it must be positive, then strictly speaking what I mean is that its expectation value is positive for all states. But equivalently, I can write this as follows. If I have the spectral decomposition of A, then the constraint can be written as all the eigenvalues are positive. So you can think of it as in this way or this way. Yes?
So we are allowed to know then, to arbitrary precision, the correlation between, let's say, x1 and t2?
Yes. Exactly. As you would quantum mechanically,
yeah.
The observable x1 and the observable p2, you could know. So maybe I'll not take you through the proof of this guy here. It comes later anyhow, and just tell you what you can do with this. So now the general starting axiom for arbitrary numbers of systems is that the distributions that you can prepare are the mu's that satisfy this, and which maximize the entropy for a given set of second-order moments. And again, you find that among all valid distributions over n canonical degrees of freedom, with a given covariance matrix, so the covariance matrix tells you all the second-order moments, it turns out the multivariate Gaussians are the ones that maximize the entropy. So you can always write them just in terms of their covariance matrix in this fancy form. Not so important. Here I'm going to skip over this proof. It might be something useful to do in tutorial. It's quite nice. It basically starts with the commutation relation for arbitrary position momentum operators, and it eventually derives this. So let me skip that. Okay, what are the valid epistemic states for a pair of these canonical systems? Well, you can have product distributions, uncorrelated distributions. If this is Gaussian, this is Gaussian, then this is fine. It's allowed. It satisfies all the constraints. But you can also have correlated distributions. And here's one. This is a limit of a Gaussian. I can squeeze in the x for the x1 minus x2 variable and squeeze the p1 plus p2 variable. In quantum mechanics, x1 minus x2 and p1 plus p2, the observables commute. And similarly, with respect to this classical uncertainty principle, there's no constraint on how much you can know about those guys. So you can know everything. This means you can know precisely what the separation of the two particles is and what their relative, what their total momentum is. And it's analogous to the entangled state that Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen used, which was, remember, you could write it in position or momentum representation, and it had exactly the same kinds of correlations. If you now ask what are the valid transformations in this theory, you know that all Hamiltonian transformations preserve the uncertainty principle. You can prove that. But only quadratic Hamiltonians preserve this Gaussian form. So you're limited now to essentially harmonic type potentials. But that still allows you to translate in phase space, rotate in phase space, and do some interesting things. You can then ask what kinds of measurements are you allowed? So the principle here is always, what would this world allow you such that you remained uncertain in this precise way? Well, the idea is you get a constraint on the sorts of measurements you can do because a measurement here on a correlated distribution prepares a distribution here. So let me give you an example. Suppose I have two particles prepared in this EPR type distribution. So they're known to be correlated in position and anti-correlated in momentum. Now, if it were possible for me to find out both position and momentum simultaneously for this guy, then I could immediately use that information to infer what the position and momentum of the other guy was. And so I would have prepared the other guy in a delta distribution, and that's not allowed. So clearly, I can't measure position and momentum simultaneously. And if you go through the math, what you find is that the kinds of indicator functions, so remember, this is the probability of getting the yes outcome given that the state was x1, p1. the kinds of indicator functions you can have are just the ones that are proportional to the valid probability distributions. The only difference is in a minus sign. And you're allowed all such indicator functions. So basically, the sorts of measurements are just like the kinds of distributions. So I could do a measurement of the position basis if I want. Resolve my uncertainty about position completely. Resolve my uncertainty about momentum completely. But in this case, I know nothing. I learned nothing about momentum. And here, I learned nothing about position. There's also a sort of a joint measurement of position momentum where for each variable, I learn a bit. So I have some uncertainty. And so I can basically form a uniform distribution by summing up Gaussians. But measurements like this, where you know x and p and arbitrary measurements, are not allowed. All right, so we're getting close to the end. In this theory, you get, you can ask, how must my distributions update during a measurement? So what you would normally expect if I was living in a classical world and I had something where I knew the momentum, and then I came along and I measured position, I would just do a Bayesian updating. I would say, well, I knew the momentum, so it's definitely here in momentum space. And now I've learned its position, so it must be that my knowledge is now that it's exactly here. But if that were the way measurements worked in the world we're imagining, the uncertainty principle would be violated. And the principle here is always just assume whatever you need to assume to make sure that that principle is maintained. So one thing you need to assume is that measurements don't work this way. What has to happen is that after this measurement's over, I'd better be left in one of these distributions that's uniform over momentum and is at the position that I've just measured. This is the only distribution that's both valid and makes this measurement result reoccur if I do it again. It makes the measurement reproducible. Hang on. So this is like the collapse of the wave function, right? It leaves me in this sort of distribution. But now you want to know, well, how does this happen physically? And it consists of two components. So there's a Bayesian updating, and then there's an actual disturbance of the system. There's a uniformly random mixture of translations over momentum. So the way that measurement works here is the first thing that happens is you update to this. But then as a result of the interaction of your system with the measurement device, you shift it in momentum space by some random amount that you don't know. And so if you've shifted this by some random amount, what you're left with is just uniform knowledge of where it lies. Michael, does that answer the question you were about to ask?
No, it makes me want to ask it even more.
Okay.
So the step from between Bayesian and updating,
yeah,
the final result,
yes,
is not Hamiltonian evolution.
That's true, it's not.
So
it's irreversible.
The measurement is a different kind of thing from the evolution of the prompt state in this model.
It's certainly
just like in quantum mechanics when you collapse the wave function.
That's right. So exactly. This is the analog of the collapse of the wave function, which is a very different kind of evolution from unitary evolution. But you can now ask the following question. Can I model my measurement apparatus as just another classical system, which is coupled via some Hamiltonian to the system I'm interested in, and understand the origin of this collapse postulate, this funny disturbance? And the answer is you can, as a Hamiltonian evolution. Let me skip this and get to what you're asking about. So here's the idea. If you measure position as an external intervention, then you don't assign this any dynamical degrees of freedom, and you just say there's an unknown disturbance to momentum, uniform over all possible translations in momentum, just like a class postulate. But now suppose instead you say, no, the way this device works is it has some particle in it, which I'm going to couple to the particle of interest via this sort of interaction Hamiltonian. So this is the one von Neumann used. He said if you couple the position of the system to the momentum of the apparatus. Now, in a classical world, you can write down such a Hamiltonian. And what it does is it translates the position of the apparatus depending on by different amounts, depending on the magnitude of the position of the system. Okay. So even classically, a momentum appearing in the Hamiltonian is a generator of translations. So what this is going to do is you're going to couple these guys together. This guy is going to be translated by an amount that depends on the position of the system, which is good, because you're trying to measure position. So then you go and you measure the position of your pointer, your probe here. And it's been translated by an amount that depends on this. So you infer what the position of this guy was by how much he's been translated. Okay. How do you have to prepare this guy initially? Well, he lives in our world, and we're assuming this constraint on what we can know. And we want to measure his displacement in space, so we'd better prepare him in a state of well-defined position. So let's prepare him in this state. Completely unknown momentum, well-defined position. Okay, that'll give us the best opportunity for measuring the position of the system. And now here's the point. When you have this sort of Hamiltonian, the final position of the apparatus comes to reflect the initial position of the system. That's what it was designed to do. But there's sort of an action-reaction principle in classical mechanics, which says also, by this symmetry, you know, you can think of this as the system measuring the momentum of the apparatus. Right? The system will be boosted proportional to the momentum of the apparatus. So the final momentum of the system comes to reflect the initial momentum of the apparatus. That's just the reaction. And so because the initial momentum of the apparatus is completely unknown, the boost to your system is also completely unknown. And so you get an unknown disturbance to the momentum of the system, which is exactly the collapse postulate you needed to preserve the uncertainty principle. The classical analog of von Neumann's argument from his 1932 textbook, where he says, if you want, you can couple unitarily to this guy via an XP coupling and then measure position on this guy, and it works just the same. So von Neumann, you know, says, look, we can put the cut between internal and external anywhere we like. It doesn't matter. And here it's the same. We can put the cut anywhere we like. And it shows us that we can understand this collapse deterministically. But the difference here is that whereas you have a measurement problem in the orthodox interpretation, if you include everything, then it looks like nothing has any well-defined properties. Schrodinger's cat is just in this funny entangled state. Here, the quantum state is like a probability distribution. So everything maintains definite properties. There is some point in phase space. And the more systems I incorporate into my description, I'm just drawing a probability distribution over a larger set. And so I'm expressing more and more my correlations between systems. But it remains the case that every system has well-defined properties. Yeah.
So what you're saying is that every system has a definite quantum state.
Yes.
But we now have limited knowledge of that state. And that limited knowledge is preserved by the Hamiltonian evolution of these distributions.
Right.
And so the uncertainty is due to that limitation of knowledge. So now I guess you have to ask the question, if there is actually a non-existent state, mm-hmm. and the state has a definite property, why can't we know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could ask why that axiom I started with. Right, I just laid it down as an axiom. But you could certainly say, can we understand that more deeply? You know, can we provide a reason for this limitation on what we know? And that's a very good question. I have speculations about that. But here I'm just showing that if you make that postulate, then you get something that manages to simulate a lot of the quantum formalism. You had a question?
Same one.
Right. Good. Okay, well, we're basically out of time. Let me flash you a couple of things. Look, I was going to say that you can get an analog of non-commutativity. So here, if I prepare an x eigenstate, I measure x, its outcome is determined. But if I measure x after p, well, the p randomizes the position, so I'll get a random outcome, just as you would in quantum mechanics with non-commutativity. You also get a natural explanation of the EPR experiment, right? So remember the setup from last time. The idea is that initially you start with this distribution where position is correlated, momentum is anti-correlated. Initially, you know nothing about the position momentum of the second system. But if you measure the position of the first system, you update your knowledge of the distant system, and you learn what its position is. So it's in some definite state, and you don't know anything about it. And you can either resolve your knowledge about position or resolve your uncertainty about momentum. Okay, so all you're doing is choosing to learn one or another thing about the distant system. Anyway, so I won't go over this, but there's something in quantum mechanics called the Wigner representation. It is defined in the following way. It's the trace of the density operator with a set of operators that are Fourier transforms of the shift and boost operators, products of shift and boost unitaries. And it turns out that this representation is very nice. It's a phase-space representation. You can also represent effects with it. And what you can find is that your quantum probabilities are just integrals of products of these Wigner distributions. OK, so that looks like maybe you can interpret these things as probabilities. Here's the probability of X and P. Here's the probability of getting some outcome given X and P. And I could represent the quantum probabilities by these sorts of formulas. You can generalize it to many systems. And what you find is that if you focus on a subset of all the quantum states, they're called the Gaussian quantum states. They're the ones whose Wigner representations are these multivariate Gaussians with a covariance matrix that satisfies the quantum uncertainty principle, then that's fine. You can do that. Those things exist. There are states with those Wigner representations. And you can prove, so I'm sorry to be running through this, but I'm going to end shortly. You can prove that these are precisely the distributions that arose in the theory I told you about. So all the distributions that are valid in this classical theory, so we were just building a restriction on knowledge of a classical theory, all those distributions are the Wigner representations of a subset of all quantum states, the Gaussian quantum states. And you can also prove that the valid measurements and the valid transformations in that theory correspond to the measurements and transformations that preserve the Gaussianity of your quantum state. And so, and they turn out to be just Wigner representations of those measurements and transformations. So the theory I told you actually is embedded in quantum theory. It is a local non-contextual hidden variable model for a part of quantum theory. So the reason all those things look so familiar is because they're models. They're perfectly good mathematical models of what happens in the experiments that use Gaussian states, Gaussian measurements, and Gaussian transformations. Okay, so what it means is that if you look at, you know, phenomena, things that you might find mysterious about quantum theory, things like non-commutativity, entanglement, Bell inequality violations, et cetera, and you try to categorize them, find those that do arise in these classical theories with an epistemic restriction, and find those that don't arise. A surprisingly large number of them come here. That's sort of the point of this lecture, is that these hidden variable theories are actually quite good at resolving mysteries for a large number of quantum phenomena, giving you a picture of what could possibly be happening, where in the quantum state is the state of knowledge. But there are certain phenomena that you can't explain in this way, like Bell inequality violations, computational speedup. The third one is contextuality, which we'll see this week, and others. So let me take your question in a moment, because I'm about to end. There are phenomena that I don't know how to characterize, so there's lots of open questions. Quantization, fermionic statistics. Can I explain them in this sort of model? I don't know. That's the big picture. For the rest of the week, we'll be going to those things and seeing the challenge they pose. So that's it for today. Sorry for keeping you over. And why don't we dismiss, and then I'll take questions from whoever wants them. Is that okay?
So you're placing